A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headaches.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. You know, Herman, I was looking at the global map of computing power this morning, and it feels like the geography of high tech is shifting right under our feet. Today's prompt from Daniel is about a massive milestone for Israel. They have officially unveiled their first domestically built 20-qubit superconducting quantum computer.
It is a huge moment, Korn. This isn't just a research project gathering dust in a basement at Hebrew University. We're talking about the Quantum QHIP initiative, which is this high-stakes collaboration between the Israel Innovation Authority, Hebrew University, their tech transfer arm YISM, and a real heavy hitter, Israel Aerospace Industries, or IAI. By the way, today's episode of My Weird Prompts is powered by Google Gemini 3 Flash. I am Herman Poppleberry, and I have been digging into the schematics of this thing all night.
I love the name QHIP. Though I suspect most people will just call it the Israeli Quantum Leap. But let's be real for a second, Herman, because I know what the skeptics are thinking. We hear about IBM and Google hitting hundreds, even 1,000 qubits with systems like IBM Condor. Does 20 qubits actually move the needle in 2026? Or is this just Israel showing up to the party with a flip phone while everyone else has a neural link?
That is the classic number go up, trap, Korn, and it's exactly what people get wrong about quantum hardware. If you just look at the qubit count, 20 sounds modest. But there is a massive difference between noisy qubits and high-fidelity qubits. IBM and Google are pushing the envelope on scale, yes, but those systems deal with incredible amounts of decoherence and error. What Israel has built here is a sovereign, full-stack system where they control every single layer from the superconducting chips to the cryogenic cooling systems.
So it's the difference between owning a small, perfectly tuned laboratory and renting time on a massive, chaotic factory floor, where you don't actually know how the machines are oiled.
That is a fair way to put it. When you build it domestically, you aren't dealing with a black box provided by a foreign vendor. In the quantum world, sovereignty is the name of the game. If you rely on a cloud provider for your quantum calculations, you are essentially sending your most sensitive algorithmic secrets to a server in Virginia or California. For a country like Israel, which prioritizes tech independence for its defense and industrial sectors, having a homegrown 20-qubit machine is a strategic fortress. It allows them to calibrate the microwave pulses and the gate operations specifically for the problems they want to solve, without asking for permission or dealing with export controls.
I see. So it's less about the raw horsepower and more about the precision tuning of the engine. But help me understand the sovereignty angle for a smaller nation. If Israel builds a 20-qubit machine today, and China or the US has a 1,000-qubit machine tomorrow, doesn't the bigger machine just win by default? Or is there a specific type of math where 20 clean qubits beat 1,000 noisy ones?
It's about the error rates, Korn. Think of it like a game of telephone. If you have 1,000 people in a line, but every single one of them is whispering and mishearing the message, by the time you get to the end, the information is garbage. That's noise in a quantum system. If Israel has 20 people who are speaking crystal clear and not making mistakes, they can actually perform complex calculations, like simulating a specific chemical bond more accurately than the giant noisy system. Plus, by owning the stack, they can implement custom error correction codes that are tailored to their specific hardware architecture. You can't do that when you're just a guest user on a cloud platform.
I noticed IAI, the aerospace giant, is right in the middle of this. That caught me off guard at first. Usually, you expect a chip manufacturer or a dedicated computer firm. Why is an aerospace company building a quantum computer? Are they planning on putting this thing in a nose cone?
Probably not in a nose cone yet, given that these things require temperatures colder than deep space to function, but IAI's involvement is actually brilliant. To build a superconducting quantum computer, you need world-class expertise in two things: extreme cryogenics and precision systems integration. Who else knows more about managing thermal loads in vacuum environments and micro-precision manufacturing than an aerospace company that builds satellites?
That makes sense. If you can keep a sensor array chilled and functional on a satellite orbiting the Earth, you've got the engineering DNA to manage a dilution refrigerator for a quantum chip.
Precisely. And it's not just the hardware. IAI deals with what we call combinatorial optimization problems every single day. Think about satellite trajectories or fleet logistics for hundreds of aircraft, or even the aerodynamic simulations for a new wing design. These are problems where the number of possible variables is so high that classical supercomputers start to choke. Even at 20 qubits, you can start running small-scale versions of these optimization algorithms to see if the quantum advantage is actually there. It's about building the muscle memory for when the hardware scales to 50 or 100 qubits.
But wait, how does an aerospace engineer actually talk to a quantum physicist? Those feel like two very different languages. Is there a risk that the academic side at Hebrew University wants to explore theoretical proofs while IAI just wants to know how to route a drone more efficiently?
That's exactly why the Quantum QHIP initiative is structured the way it is. It's a literal bridge. The academics provide the fundamental physics, the how do we keep these qubits entangled, and the IAI engineers provide the how do we make this thing survive a power surge or a vibration. A fun fact about these collaborations, often the biggest hurdle isn't the math, it's the plumbing. You have engineers who are used to building fuel lines for rockets working alongside physicists who are using specialized helium-3 isotopes to reach 10 millikelvin. It's a marriage of extreme plumbing and extreme math.
It's like training on a flight simulator before you jump into the cockpit of a jet. You want to make sure your software and your engineers know how to handle the physics before the stakes get infinitely higher. But let's talk about the tech itself. They went with superconducting qubits. We've talked about different architectures before, like trapped ions or photonics. Why go the superconducting route?
Superconducting qubits are currently the most mature path, even if they are temperamental. They use Josephson junctions, which are these tiny superconducting loops that allow current to flow without resistance. By hitting them with specific microwave pulses, you can put the qubit into a superposition of 0 and 1. The reason Israel likely chose this is because it leverages existing semiconductor fabrication techniques. Israel already has a world-class chip design ecosystem. They can use the same clean rooms and lithography tools they use for high-end electronics to iterate on these quantum chips.
So they're playing to their strengths. They aren't trying to reinvent the entire wheel. They're just making the wheel out of a material that works at near absolute zero. But what does the daily life of this quantum QHIP lab look like? The press release mentioned design, simulation, and adaptation of practical applications. That sounds like a lot of corporate speak for, we're still figuring it out.
It's actually a very specific workflow. In practice, adaptation means building the middleware. Imagine you're a chemist at a pharmaceutical startup in Tel Aviv. You have a molecular structure you want to simulate to see how it binds to a specific protein. You can't just type that into a quantum computer. You need a software layer that translates that chemical formula into a series of microwave pulses that the 20-qubit chip can understand. The QHIP lab is essentially building the bridge between the real world and the quantum hardware.
So they're the translators. They're making sure the quantum computer speaks human, and the humans speak quantum. I can see how that becomes a massive competitive advantage. If you have a dedicated lab doing that translation work, you're going to find practical uses way faster than a country just waiting for the next IBM update.
And they are focusing on classical quantum hybrids. This is a key point most people miss. We aren't going to have a purely quantum computer doing everything. Instead, you have a standard classical supercomputer doing 99% of the heavy lifting, and it offloads the most mathematically impossible 1% to the 20-qubit quantum processor. It's like having a specialized consultant who only comes in to solve the hardest part of the puzzle.
I like that. The quantum chip is the high-priced specialist who only works 10 minutes a day but saves you 3 years of work. But walk me through a concrete example. If I'm a logistics manager at the port of Haifa, how does a 20-qubit specialist actually help me? Is it literally just faster, or does it think differently?
It thinks in probability landscapes. A classical computer looks at a map and says, let's try route A, now let's try route B, now route C. It checks them one by one. A quantum computer, even a small 20-qubit one, can represent the entire state space of all routes simultaneously. It finds the lowest energy path, which in your case is the most efficient route for 500 cargo ships, by letting the quantum waves interfere with each other. The wrong answers cancel each other out, and the right answer is amplified. Even with 20 qubits, you can solve small sub-problems of that port logistics nightmare that a classical computer might take hours to brute force.
Now, looking at the bigger picture, Daniel's prompt mentions this sovereign quantum race. It feels like every nation is suddenly terrified of being left behind. Is this the new space race?
It is exactly like the space race, but with even higher stakes for national security. We are seeing what I call quantum nationalism. The United States and China are obviously the front runners, pouring tens of billions into their programs. But look at the middle powers. India just launched a national quantum mission with over $700 million. The UK, Germany, Australia, they all have these massive sovereign strategies.
Why the sudden panic? Is it all about breaking encryption? The quantum apocalypse where every password on Earth becomes useless.
That's the big bad. In the room, yes. Shor's algorithm proves that a sufficiently powerful quantum computer could crack RSA encryption, which protects everything from your bank account to nuclear launch codes. But we are still years away from a machine with enough error-corrected qubits to do that. The real race right now is about economic and industrial supremacy. If you are the first country to use quantum simulation to create a room-temperature superconductor, or a battery with 5 times the energy density of lithium ion, you don't just win a trophy. You own the global economy for the next 50 years.
It's the material science gold rush. If I can model a new stealth coating or a more efficient fertilizer process using a quantum computer while you're still trying to run the math on a classical cluster, I'm basically playing chess while you're playing checkers.
And there is a high probability that there are more programs than we are hearing about. Think about it, Korned. If you were a major intelligence agency and you made a breakthrough in quantum computing that could give you a massive edge in signals intelligence or cryptography, would you put out a press release?
Probably not. You'd bury that so deep it would make the Manhattan Project look like a public park. I bet there are black budget quantum labs in half a dozen countries right now that are technically years ahead of what's being published in academic journals.
It's almost a certainty. Quantum technology is the ultimate dual-use asset. The same math that optimizes a civilian power grid can optimize a missile defense system. The same simulation that finds a new drug can find a new chemical weapon. That's why Israel is treating this as a national security priority. They can't afford to be on the outside looking in.
Let's dig into that dual-use tension. If the Hebrew University is involved, they usually want to publish their findings in Nature's or Science. But if IAI and the Innovation Authority are funding it for national security, do those two worlds clash? How do you keep a breakthrough sovereign while still participating in the global scientific community?
That is the tightrope walk of the decade. Usually, the hardware architecture and the fundamental physics are published. That's how you attract the best PhD students. But the VQE, or variational quantum eigensolver, the specific algorithm you use to simulate a new explosive or a stealth material that stays behind the firewall. It's like sharing the recipe for the bread but keeping the secret sauce for the sandwich to yourself. Israel is particularly good at this dual-track system, where academia feeds the defense sector without stifling the scientific growth of the university.
So, let's bring this down to earth for a second. We've talked about satellites and stealth codings and national security. What does the average person living in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or anywhere else get out of this? Why should a taxpayer care that their government is spending hundreds of millions on a machine that requires a laundry list of liquid helium just to turn on?
It sounds abstract, but the trickle-down from quantum research is going to be massive. Take drug discovery, for example. Right now, developing a new life-saving medicine takes about 10 years and billions of dollars because so much of it is trial and error in a wet lab. Quantum computers can simulate how a drug molecule interacts with human proteins at the atomic level. We could cut that 10-year window down to months. That means faster cures for diseases and lower healthcare costs for everyone.
I'll take a faster cure for the common cold over a 1,000-qubit machine any day. What about the power grid? You mentioned energy.
That's a huge one. Managing a modern energy grid, especially with fluctuating sources like wind and solar, is a nightmare of an optimization problem. You have to balance load and demand in real time across millions of nodes. Quantum algorithms are perfect for this. If we can optimize the grid just 5 or 10% better, we reduce carbon emissions and lower energy bills significantly. It's the kind of invisible benefit that people won't realize comes from quantum computing, but it will change their daily lives.
But how close are we to that grid optimization? Are we talking 2027 or 24/7? Because people are paying their electric bills today.
We're in the NISQ era, noisy intermediate scale quantum. We are likely looking at the first real industrial impacts in the next 3 to 5 years. It starts with small things, like optimizing the delivery routes for a single shipping company or finding a slightly more efficient catalyst for industrial ammonia production. Ammonia production alone uses about 2% of the world's energy. If a quantum computer finds a way to make that process even 1% more efficient, the energy savings are astronomical. That's the kind of boring breakthrough that changes the world.
It's the ultimate behind-the-scenes upgrade. Like when the internet moved from dial-up to fiber, most people didn't care about the physics of light and glass cables. They just liked that their videos didn't buffer. Quantum computing is going to be the fiber for the world's most complex problems.
And don't forget financial security. As we develop these quantum computers, we are also forced to develop quantum-safe encryption or post-quantum cryptography. The research happening at Hebrew University and the QHIP lab isn't just about building the attacker machine, it's about building the shield. They are making sure that when the quantum apocalypse headlines eventually hit, the citizen's bank account and medical records are already protected by new math that even a quantum computer can't crack.
So it's a double-sided coin. They're building the sword to stay competitive and the shield to stay safe. I think what's really interesting here is the National Quantum Initiative budget, which is around 1.25 billion shekels. That is a serious commitment for a country of 9 million people. It shows that they aren't just dipping their toes in the water, they are diving into the deep end.
It's a huge investment, but when you consider that Israel's tech sector is the engine of their entire economy, it's actually a very logical insurance policy. If the world shifts to a quantum-based economy and you don't have the hardware, the software, or the talent pipeline, your tech sector becomes obsolete overnight. This 20-qubit machine is a training ground. It's where the next generation of Israeli physicists and engineers are going to learn how to operate in a world where bits aren't enough.
It's a talent magnet. If you're a brilliant PhD student, you're going to go where the hardware is. By building this domestically, Israel is ensuring that their best and brightest stay home and build the next big quantum startup in Herzliya instead of moving to Silicon Valley or Zurich.
And we are already seeing that ecosystem grow. The collaboration with YISM, the tech transfer company, is key. They are the ones who take a discovery in a university lab and turn it into a patent and eventually a company. That lab-to-market pipeline is what Israel does better than almost anyone. This 20-qubit machine is the heart of that new engine.
I wonder, though, how much of this is about quantum pride? There is a certain prestige to being in the quantum club. It's like having a nuclear program or a space agency. It signals to the world that you are a first-tier technological power.
There is definitely a diplomatic element to it. When you have your own quantum computer, you aren't just a customer, you are a partner. It gives you a seat at the table when international standards for quantum communication or encryption are being written. You have skin in the game.
Skin in the game usually involves a lot of liquid nitrogen in this case, but I get the point. So, for the tech professionals listening, what's the takeaway? If you're a developer or a researcher, should you be dropping everything to learn Qiskit or Circ right now?
You should definitely be paying attention to the hardware roadmaps. Don't just look at the qubit count. Look at the gate fidelity and the connectivity. The QHIPU lab is focusing on these metrics because that's what actually determines if an algorithm will run correctly. If you're in tech, you need to understand that we're moving toward a hybrid world. You don't need to be a quantum physicist, but you should understand how to identify quantum-ready problems in your own industry. Is there an optimization bottleneck in your supply chain? Is there a simulation in your R&D that takes 2 weeks to run? Those are the places where quantum advantage will hit first.
Does that mean we're going to see quantum as a service from Israeli startups? Like, hey, don't buy a dilution refrigerator, just API into our 20-qubit chip for your logistics problem.
That is exactly the business model. Startups like Quantum Machines, which is an Israeli company, are already building the control systems that other people use to run their quantum computers. Israel is positioning itself to be the operating system provider for the quantum age. They want to be the ones who provide the brains and the nerves, even if IBM provides the muscles.
It's about being quantum literate. You don't need to build the engine, but you need to know how to drive the car. And for investors, I guess the signal here is that national funding is the canary in the coal mine. When governments start dropping billions on a specific tech stack, the private sector isn't far behind.
The talent pipeline is the most valuable asset here. Watch where the R&D credits and the university grants are going. In Israel, it's clear quantum is the new frontier. We are going to see a wave of quantum-adjacent startups in everything from cybersecurity to materials science coming out of this initiative.
I'm still stuck on the image of an aerospace company building a computer. It feels like such a 2026 thing to happen. It's like the silos between industries are just dissolving. You can't be a top-tier aerospace firm anymore without being a top-tier computing firm.
The physical and the digital are merging, Korn. Whether you're building a satellite or a quantum processor, you're dealing with the same fundamental challenges of precision, temperature control, and complex systems. IAI is just proving that they can play in both worlds.
It's a bold move. I'm curious to see if this 20-qubit machine stays a research tool, or if we see a press release in a year saying IAI has optimized their entire satellite constellation using it. That would be the real aha moment for the public.
I suspect the practical applications will come sooner than people think. Even if it's just a toy version of a problem, proving that a quantum classical hybrid can outperform a purely classical approach is the Kitty Hawk moment for this technology. And once you have that proof of concept, the scaling becomes a matter of engineering and investment, not just theoretical physics.
It's the quantum Kitty Hawk. I like that. We're still on the beach in North Carolina, but we're definitely off the ground. But even at Kitty Hawk, people were skeptical. They said it only flew for 12 seconds. What's the 12-second equivalent for QHIPU? What's the first thing they're going to prove?
It will likely be a random circuit sampling test or a small-scale simulation of a hydrogen molecule. To a layman, it sounds like nothing. But to a physicist, it's the sound of a new era of computation clearing its throat. It proves that the entanglement is working, that the gates are coherent, and that the domestic supply chain for quantum parts is viable.
And the beach is getting crowded. But having your own plane, even a small one, is a lot better than waiting for a ticket on someone else's airline.
And remember, once you have the plane, you can start training the pilots. Israel is training a whole generation of quantum pilots right now. By the time the 1,000-qubit machines are standard, Israel will have a workforce that has been flying quantum systems for years, that human capital is arguably more valuable than the hardware itself.
Well, I, for one, am glad the brothers Poppleberry are here to track the flight path. This is one of those topics that sounds like science fiction until you realize the hardware is actually sitting in a room in Jerusalem right now, humming away at nearly absolute zero.
It's very real, Korn, and it's only going to get weirder from here.
That's the brand, Herman. That is the brand. I think we've covered the what and the why pretty thoroughly. The how is still being written in those labs, but I'm excited to see the first real-world results that trickle out of the QHIPU initiative.
Keep an eye on the publications coming out of Hebrew University. That's where the early warnings of quantum advantage will appear.
I'll leave the heavy reading to you, Erman. I'll stick to the deadpan observations and the occasionally insightful questions.
It's a winning combination.
Before we wrap up, I want to say thanks as always to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the gears turning behind the scenes.
And a big thanks to Modal for providing the GPU credits that power this show. They make this kind of deep dive exploration possible. This has been My Weird Prompts.
If you're finding these deep dives useful, a quick review on your favorite podcast app helps us reach more curious minds like yours. We'll be back soon with more weird prompts and hopefully fewer cryogenics. Related puns from Herman.
No promises on the puns, Corn. I've got a few more cooling down in the fridge.
I figured as much. See you next time.
Goodbye.
This episode was produced using Google Gemini 3 Flash. Text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where our thoughts go from slow, slow takes to facts on cue. We change and follow through. My Weird Prompts, that's the close from sloth.